Welcome to Wine Road, the wine, when, and where of Northern Sonoma County. I'm your host, Marcy Gordon, with Beth Costa, Executive Director of the Wine Road.
Thanks to Ron Rubin, we're able to keep our podcast rolling along. The financial support of River Road Family Vineyards and Winery allows us to keep recording, keep sipping wine, and keep sharing stories with our listeners. Check out their website at riverroadvineyards.com and explore their Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Old Vine Zinfandel from the Russian River Valley, as well as a finely crafted Cabernet Sauvignon from the Alexander Valley. That's riverroadvineyards.com. And hey, thanks, Ron, for allowing us to make this show happen.
Welcome to episode 197. Today, our guest is Lucas Meeker. He's the co-owner and winemaker at Meeker Vineyards, and he's brought us some very exciting bottles to talk about. So welcome, Lucas. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So what is it that we opened?
This is our Pop Punk number 7. It's a pet nat of the juice bleed from the Mazzoni Home Vineyard in Alexander Valley, which is a pretty well-known single vineyard red wine with Ridge for a long time. And now it's we've been making red wine out of it, and pet nat from the bleed juice. The first vines were planted in 1899. You know, they call it a Zinfandel vineyard, the Otranti family who owns it now, and it certainly feels like a Zinfandel vineyard, but there's definitely some Golden Chasselas.
Kind of a field blend, yeah.
Oh, it's a very field blend.
Yeah.
and, you know, a lot of, as you guys well know, that there's a lot of old vine vineyards in this area and the North Coast in general that are quote-unquote Zinfandel. And they are certainly core Zinfandel, but...
Dang, this is
I love this.
Nice, yes.
Yeah, we started making Pet Nat in 2019, question mark, about there. And really the original motivation for us was that I really, really like sparkling wine. And like my dad, who I think...
Lucas, meet Beth. Beth, yeah. Meet Lucas.
I never really...
And also, it's both me and our wine club director, Catherine, who are the sparkling wine people. And, you know, I grew up around my dad who really took advantage of the fact that he didn't have to pay for wine because he made it. And so for me, I was just like, you know, it's really unfortunate that I have to go pay for wine. I don't want to do that anymore. So, you know, my dad and I for years had made a few over the course of about a decade, taking a few cracks at making base wine for sparkling. And while every time we'd kind of get to the stage, it was like, okay, time to go into to bottle it and make a traditional method sparkling wine. And we'd get, you know, quotes on having somebody else do it. And they were always wildly expensive.
Right.
And not to say that it's not worth
not
every
the
penny.
Value. Right.
Yeah, no, it's a very technical process with specialized equipment that we don't have.
Right.
100%, you know, it's the value's there. But it wasn't, but we, you know, Beth will tell you this. We've been kind of very blue collar and DIY. We really like to figure it out ourselves. It's always been our kind of path. You know, I plumbed our glycol system for fun. So yeah, for me, sending the wine off to have somebody else do it just didn't feel like the point. And so we never actually took any of those base sparkling wines that we made for traditional method to bottle. And, you know, around the late teens, we saw that Pet Nat started to catch on a little bit with the rise of the natural wine trend. And also we saw that really the big driver for me was that we saw people across the country start to drink hazy IPAs and not be really offended by cloudy beverages at scale. And to me, that was the rise of Pet Nat existing was that's something we'd known about for a long time. But really the kind of adoption of hazy IPAs and hazy beers in general, besides your occasional wheat, was the kind of trigger. It was like people are ready.
Your tipping point.
Yeah,
for
people
it.
Are well, ready to not judge something because it's cloudy now.
Right. That is interesting because in the marketplace, there's a lot of things that influence people's decisions and you know how they come to know something or like something, and because it's new and so people are always suspicious. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. A big part of what we've always done is tried to push people's expectations outside of where they might have been comfortable before they walked into our space. And so anytime we're trying to do that, we're also trying to think about you can make people uncomfortable, but you can't make them completely uncomfortable, right? You have to give them kind of something to lean on or part of, you know, they're willing to step halfway out of the circle, but they're not willing to dive in. And so we're always looking for ways to kind of, when we do want to do something weird or different, which we do a lot of that, we really want to kind of find a way to bring people into it that's going to be comfortable for them, but also feel, you know, something that they can latch onto that they understand already, not just comfort, but also existing knowledge. People are really willing to try something new when they have the context to place that information when they get it. You can make them feel comfortable, but if they're comfortable and they still don't have the information,
it still doesn't connect. Yeah. Well, this connects.
That connected quite nicely.
Yeah, you know, we started the Pop Punk series in 2019. You know, I grew up listening to punk and pop punk as well, and for us, it's really about sending the message that these are wines that are, you know, we take them very seriously in how we make them and how we craft them, but they're not necessarily meant to be taken super seriously in the sense that we think the quality's there. We're especially going out of our way to use really great fruit from really great places.
Right.
You know, I'd find me a Petnat made from a vineyard planted in 1899.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, to a certain extent, that's very much intentional. I think that, you know, we could have done very well making a Zin Rosé from 1899 planted vines, but making a Petnat out of it is kind of dumb. And we kind of relish that opportunity to do something intentionally dumb. I tell my cellar team every year.
I'm glad you did it. I love the texture. Yeah. I love the heft, but the brilliance comes up too. There's a lot going on in this. That's what I like
beautiful.
In a wine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things.
That's going to get a manicure later to this color.
It's going to be that color. It's beautiful.
Someone on our team asked me to write tasting notes for this wine. I'm like, it tastes like magenta.
Yeah.
And they were like, anything else? I was like, water slides?
Like
tastes like water slides and magenta. I don't
like
know.
Like magenta
the problem
from
water
Rocky
slides.
Horror.
Yeah. What else do you need? It's excellent. And so, yeah, what really is great about these wines, the whole Pop Punk series, is that we're trying to do some of them every year. If they're excellent, we try and do them again for sure. But we're kind of using it as a crowbar to kind of seeing what the limits of sparkling wine are.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to make Petnat a much more full carbonation than most other Petnats. We're really enjoying it.
I experienced that this morning.
Yeah. We really are shooting for between 4 and 5 bar, which, you know, champagne is typically 5 to 6.
Okay.
Traditionally, Petnat would be like 2 to 3. And so we're really pushing on, you know, I tell our customers we're trying to get 90%+ of what you enjoy about single vineyard or grower champagne, but with maybe parts you don't expect, like using different vineyards and varieties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then also at half the price. And we feel like the QPR is there.
Right.
If we're 90% of the enjoyment at half the price, we're you know.
And it's got that vitality. And, you know, one of the big issues facing the wine industry is getting younger people to drink wine. They are already big beer aficionados. They like hazy IPAs. Here is your gateway.
Yeah, you know,
wine.
That's actually, I think, that part of it's particularly of import for us. We have such an old school style in our red wine execution that really a big focus of mine making wines over the past 10 years has been, you know, the term we use internally is how do we build the ramp?
Right.
We have such a kind of, it's now an esoteric style. 20, 30 years ago, our style wasn't esoteric. It was kind of the core of red wine in this mm-hmm. area. But we kind of, I tell people, we never took our Miami Vice white blazer off. We kind of stuck ourselves firmly in that kind of chasing the old world structure and ageability and have never gotten sick of that. And so a big challenge for me has been, how do we introduce people? How do we get them to understand what we're doing, but in a way where we're not compromising our values or what we're interested in?
Right, of course. Yeah. Well, I think this is a good ramp.
Yeah, no, that's the very, very low end of the ramp, and it's a very fun part of the ramp.
Yeah, excellent.
So what are the other wines that we brought?
So I brought 3 other wines that kind of cover a gamut of the things that, you know, for someone who's never maybe visited us before might be kind of covering the old and the new and kind of our kind of revisiting of our own traditions.
Mm-hmm.
I brought a wine from our Snapshot series called Type 2 Fun. It's a blend of Mourvedre, Grenache, and Syrah. It's all over the North Coast fruit, but my dad had a long tradition of being obsessed with chasing every major red grape he could, especially French red grapes. You know, we were making 3 different single vineyard Carignans in 1999.
Oh, my Lord, yeah.
You know, my dad loved finding things he hadn't done before and then doing them. And that was the way he kept himself engaged and excited. And Mourvedre was actually the only major French red grape that my dad didn't make before he passed away in 2021. And so in 2021, I decided it was time. So we went and found a Mourvedre vineyard actually in Lake County, not local, but there's just not a ton of Mourvedre around here. It's actually a pretty, given how excellent I actually think it is for our area, it's actually pretty surprising how rarely it's planted.
Right.
There are some plantings coming in Dry Creek, but it's still, you know, pretty rare and also frequently called Mataro by the people who are planting it locally.
Hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. There's, you know, 7 different names for Mourvedre, 4 that people know. And we, yeah, we wanted to check it off the list. I mean, it was a way to honor my dad and also to kind of continue that tradition that we've always had of, you know, what's the next grape we haven't done yet? And let's go check it off the list.
Nice. So, yeah. I love your packaging, by the way. You have like some really great dynamic labels, the Pop Punk, this Type 2. Fun is such a cool label.
Yeah, the Snapshot series of wines, this is, I think, the 7th wine in the Snapshot series, maybe 6th. Is every blend is different. They all have a story. The kind of idea is that, you know, a picture tells a thousand is a story, you know, tells a story of 1,000 words. And so there's a picture on the front that's unique to each wine with its own name. And the idea is actually to kind of take people's context for approaching the wine away from the varieties, because we're chasing an idea with these wines. And the idea might be as simple as, hey, what does our version of a GSM look like? And that's kind of the simplest way to chase this one. This one's also a collaboration with a pro cyclist who I'm friends with, Pete Stetna. So that's where the name Type 2 Fun comes from. But, you know, the first wine in the Snapshot series was called No Siesta. It was a blend of Zin and Syrah. We've had one called Directrix that was Cab Franc and Syrah. We, one called Make It New that was kind of our riff on Gigonda. So it was a Grenache-led blend. These are wines that essentially tell the story of a moment where we had an idea and we wanted to capitalize on that idea with wine that we were already making. So it's really, these are wines that are stories about blending and stories about how you can achieve things in the winery by thinking creatively and blending creatively with different goals in mind. The Snapshot series is really about blending with intent. Mm-hmm. We have another series of wine called the Hone series that are also kind of picture framed type ideas, but those wines are really about purely experiments, new varieties, new vineyards, new tactics. Probably the most successful one we've had is Hone Number 3, which was a fully carbonic fermentation of Dolcetto, which at the time thought was the only fully carbonic Dolcetto on the planet. Apparently,
it's only one I've heard of.
There apparently have been a couple other that beat us to the punch by a year or two, but we were doing it, you know, we've been doing it at scale up to 5 tons over the past few vintages. So we, you know, we really try and chase down these things that are maybe not just even new to us, but maybe just new, and really try and see what the boundaries of our abilities are.
Well, was your path always going to follow your father and be in wine? Or what? Tell me about your path, because I get the feeling maybe you were going to be a poet or some liberal arts.
I feel like you read my bio.
I didn't read your bio, I feel the vibe.
People ask me all the time if my degree's in winemaking. My degree's in English.
I knew it.
Yeah, I went to Colgate in upstate New York,
Central
New York.
Colgate. And
I was never planning on being a winemaker. I would also tell you that I wasn't planning on leaving the winery behind either. To me, the winery was something that was part of my identity, part of my family. And it was something that kind of like my dad, where he actually founded the winery when he was 35, believe it or not.
Wow.
But then was the head winemaker while we were super small. And then as we scaled up, he needed to bring people in to actually kind of run the show for him on day to day. But then when he was kind of done with the bulk of his career in LA, we moved back up here full time. He became the winemaker again full time and took over day to day management in 1998, 99. And so we, you know, to me, that kind of arc of it being something that was part of me and part of what I did and what I understood was always part of the plan, but the plan was definitely to go have a career in something else. I came home. Both my parents asked my sister and I to come work for the winery for a few years after college before we then went off and did whatever we were going to do. She did as well. Beth knows my sister well. And, you know, my timing was that I graduated college in 07, the recession hit in 08. And it's, I think, hard for people to understand, but, you know, my dad would call my school and say, hey, I'll have the tuition check for you. We just got to bill our wine club.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, when you kind of hear that and you know, you're around it, you understand really, you know, and not in a, in not trying to sound like, you know, underprivileged or something, but, you know, that the winery provided for me in a way that was important material to my education and my life. And so for me, when the recession hit, and I was already at the winery and I had actually started making my own wines at that point. It was clear to me that it was the right thing to do to stay and help the winery like it had helped me. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And then it just kind of some things happen, and you know, and here we are.
Yeah, that's most,
well,
yeah. most of life.
Just
one thing
hearing you
another.
Speak of the wine, you have a narrative. Definitely, you have this feeling to me. It's like I always compare winemakers to writers, because what you're putting in that bottle is the prose. It's your choice of those words, that phraseology, and I feel that has a good analogy. Wine and writing.
Yeah, I love that metaphor. Actually, I wouldn't say that I've ever heard that necessarily, or even framed like that. But I would say the one thing that I've been kind of kicking against over the past few years is this alternative marketing framework. That's the idea that a winemaker's job is to get out of the way. And oh. non-interventionist or low interventionist. Right. And first of all, you know, the two most important decisions any winemaker makes are when you pick and when you bottle, and then the choices you make in between and before and after too. But certainly those are the two most fundamental choices that any winemaker makes, because it affects the ripeness of the fruit and the readiness of the wine. And everyone has to make those,
right,
or else you end up with raisins or vinegar.
Right.
So, you know, the idea that any wine is non-interventionist is, to me, laughable. We're farming, you know, Vitis vinifera grapevines grafted on vinifera lambrusca hybrid rootstocks, you know. And every vinifera vine we're using has been bred for, you know, at least hundreds of years, like, you know, standard poodles have been. So the idea that anything that we're doing is fundamentally natural when we go clear a field to plant these vines is, you know, is nature our partner? 100%. Mother Nature is my partner.
Right.
But what we do is not natural. It's not fundamentally natural. It's actually the course of winemaking history is to drive it away from the purely natural. Yeah, this is our job. It's the job.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
My job is, you know, chief interventionist.
Right.
So to me, it's really about trying to communicate with people clearly about what our goals are, what we do, why we make the decisions we make, and what matters to us.
Tell us about the other two wines.
So Fossil is a blend that we started making in the mid-00s. My dad did some consulting work. My dad's previous career was in the movie business. And
another great label.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie. I was looking for an excuse to put a T-Rex on a label.
Yeah, well,
it might be quite that simple. I actually do all our graphic design in-house, too. That was my first job at the winery.
You do? Like, you did this label? You do all the graphic mm-hmm. design? Oh, my Lord.
I have since 2000.
Oh, my gosh.
Since I was in college.
Yeah, you have such fun labels. That's awesome.
The only idea kind of in the current lineup that I didn't come up with is the handprint, which we'll talk about next.
Mm-hmm.
So Fossil, you know, there's a traditional blend in Australia, Cab Sauv Merlot, which is, you know, in Australia mm-hmm. super common. It's, you know, it's essentially the historical hand-me-down of what we call Hermitage Bordeaux, which, you know, prior to French Appellation wine regulations, all the big Bordeaux houses had a second wine that was a blend of typically Hermitage Syrah in with their claret, and that was their second wine. And you know, even Ben Franklin writes about these wines in some of his writing. Hmm. And a lot of those wines traded in London, because London was actually easier to get wine to than Paris, because of you could go by mm-hmm. boat mm-hmm. via, you know, Bordeaux through the Channel. And oftentimes those clarets with the Syrah on them were traded at a higher value or were more sought after than those, you know, Bordeaux only blends. And so my dad, you know, went to Australia for 3 weeks for this consulting job and drank a bunch of CSM and came back and said, I have this great idea. And those are normally difficult conversations for me historically when my dad would say, I have this great idea. It's like, oh, God.
Here we go again.
Here we go again. But this was a pretty good one. And so we tried to find a way, you know, we have regulations about what words we can use on labels. And we can't say, oh, it's Hermitage Bordeaux. Because it's not Hermitage, it's not Bordeaux.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to even communicate that. So we wanted to find a way to kind of communicate that we weren't discovering this, that we were kind of repolishing.
Uncovering it.
Yeah, we were uncovering something that has long existed and trying to do it here our way.
Nice.
Yeah.
With a T-Rex.
Yeah, and, you know, T-Rex, right?
I mean, we'll pictures of this in our show notes mm-hmm. because these have to be seen. So cool.
Yeah. And then the last one we brought is probably the most, you know, fundamental kind of I've been joking with people that my dad might be spinning in his grave. My dad for 30 years talked about our handprint Merlot as, you know, we weren't ever going to make any other variety in the handprint package, because one of the things that we loved about it was that it got people's attention, got them to focus on Merlot, mm-hmm. which unfortunately over the past 20 years particularly has become a much maligned grape and completely errantly. You know, Merlot is arguably the grape. Historically speaking, Petrus is maybe the most sought after red wine in the world, and it's primarily Merlot, sometimes over 90%. So we,
Well, it just shows you how the power of fiction.
Yeah.
One person's
exactly.
line in a movie, in a yeah. book, can, create
havoc.
Ripples for a lifetime.
I try not to talk about that movie anymore because there's even details in the movie and in the script that are, the sought after wine in that movie is Cheval Blanc, which is a blend of Cab Franc and Merlot.
Right.
And in the original script, it actually says, give me anything but Merlot, comma, it was my wife's favorite wine. Can you imagine how different my life would be if that hadn't, been cut from the actual shot? We've been sitting here, holding up the flag for Merlot for 30 years and very proud of our work with Merlot. We make a wine that we believe consistently ages for 20 to 30 years plus. Most of our Bordeaux varieties or Bordeaux type blends are like that. We really have a huge focus on legitimate age-worthy winemaking. Every winery in the area, Napa here, anywhere else will tell you that their wines are going to age for 30 years. And ironically, a lot of them haven't even been open for 30 years.
Yeah.
We do, and our wines do. We've been selling wine from our library. Lazy Bear and Cyrus have been carrying 80s vintage wines of ours and enjoying them, regularly. We truly believe in age-worthy winemaking. It's something that requires intent, and it requires sacrifice. We sacrifice the wine's friendliness at a young age to make sure that we're building a wine that's got it for the long haul. And so a big part of that ramp that we have to build is to teach people a lot of times, yes, our wines are not wildly fruity like something
Teach
else might
patience.
Be. But what they're also telling you is that they've got something else in store for you. And, we also have customers who are like, I'm 78. I don't care if your wine age is 20 years. And, of course not. So, for us, it's hard to be a California winery and say, just wait 20 years. A big part of my dad's drive over his winemaking arc was to find the way to balance legitimate age worthiness with readiness at bottling. And so we barrel age longer than most California wineries. I mean, even our kind of medium aging Grenaches see 20 to 24 months in barrel. Our Cabs and Merlots typically see 30 to 36 months in barrel. We've got a Cab program we're building right now that sees 48 months in barrel. We put our money where our mouth is. We're one of the few wineries where people come and they're like, I really want to buy birth year wine for my kids. And I'm like, got you, fam. Like, we can do that for you. Buy Fossil, buy Four Kings, buy, our single vineyard Cab, buy Merlot. And
it'll be good when
your kid will love it when
yeah.
they're 21.
Yeah.
I can't 100% guarantee it, but I can also say that our track record
Confidence,
speaks for itself.
Right.
Yeah.
My birth year wine would have to be an aged port at this point.
There's a lot of beautiful California Zins drinking from the 60s and 70s right now. You just got to go find them. They're hard to find.
Oh, you flatter me. The 60s
yeah.
and 70s.
60s and 70s. Oh, yeah.
It's also not my first rodeo making presumptions about people's age in a winemaking setting.
Too funny.
I tell people all the time, they're like, well, you have no idea. Hold on. I'm like, well, I bet your 35 birthday party was great.
It's just last week.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
20 years ago.
But no, so the handprint Cab is a big change for us. My dad for 30 years. We're only going to make Merlot, But, you can only fight the tide for so long. And while we don't plan on going anywhere with handprint Merlot, and it's still our flagship
right.
wine. So the idea here is that handprint Merlot will still be the flagship of the two handprints, but that the handprint Cab it's at a higher price, and we'll probably expect to sell maybe half as much. We don't expect to make as much as we make at the handprint Merlot, and we expect to, slide it in there as kind of the premium upgrade option. But we actually think it's going to bring people to the handprint Merlot too.
Right.
Because,
a lot of ramps going on in the freeway at Meeker.
Yeah. And the way we make Merlot is so much like Cab that anytime we can bring a Cab drinker to our Merlot, they're shocked. And so, we're a big fan of that. And, hard to talk about on a podcast, but since early 1990s, when we started making this wine, we grab every single bottle with paint on our hands. It's always one of the winemakers. I've been hand printing since 2008. I think I got an early promotion so that I could start hand printing for my dad.
Print. Yeah.
I walked in the office one day. He was like, what size are your hands? And I was like, I'm not telling you.
Never commit a crime.
Yeah.
I know that's what I've always thought.
Fingerprints are here.
Yeah. But no, I've probably hand printed somewhere between a quarter million and half a million bottles.
That's crazy.
And,
wow.
I would have so much more free time. But it's a four-person process. We really do every bottle. There's no machine. There's no trick. I've told people there's a very high bounty if you can come up with the machine.
Yeah.
There's no AI handprint.
No, there's no AI. I wish. But yeah, it's what's really cool about it, and Beth knows this, that the trick of marketing is getting people to understand something without feeling forced.
Right.
And what's beautiful about this is it's not forced. This tells a really clear story and a really clear message about who we are as a winery. We have, if we make the time to do this, it tells you we can't possibly be making that much wine or else we wouldn't have the time for the winemaking. Mm. It tells a message about how we feel about our wines. And, you know, I think it reinforces, I think for a lot of winemakers, you know, they really believe that the wines they put out are a reflection of who they are and what their values are. And we certainly feel that way. And this is a good way of proving it.
Time for our Fast Five. Who do we have on the line now?
Hi, it's Glenn from Emeritus.
Hey, Glenn.
Oh my God, it's so great to hear from you again.
Yeah. What's your Fast Five?
Well, my Fast Five is a recipe that I've been using a lot recently as kind of a dressing. You can use it on salads or cucumbers or kind of anything you want. But essentially, it's an Asian-inspired dressing where it's mostly vinegar with a little bit of toasted sesame oil, a little bit of chopped up garlic, some chili crunch if you like things to be a little spicy.
I'd have to leave that out at my house.
Oh, and just a dash of soy sauce. And honestly, the longer you let it sit and kind of meld together, the better it is.
Right.
All right. So we have vinegar, chili.
Yep. Some chili crunch.
Chili crunch. Yeah.
Soy.
Uh-huh.
Garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the fifth element?
Toasted sesame.
Toasted sesame. I love this. You know, I make something similar that's with carrot, and it's grated carrot, and it's very similar to what you get in a Japanese restaurant on the little side salad. This is a great kind of thing. You can use it on anything, chicken, salad. I love this little recipe.
Yeah, I would like that just on some cucumbers. I don't always want a salad, but I like just like some fresh tomatoes sliced
or
something.
On cucumbers.
But I want some sort of dressing on.
Yeah, and sesame oil is so savory. Yes.
Yeah, sesame oil is
nice.
Killer. Nice job. Okay.
All righty. We'll put that in the show notes. Thank you, Glenn.
Perfect.
Thanks for calling. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
We just celebrated, you know, this past 2023 harvest was our 40th harvest as a winery.
Wow.
My dad and mom bought our first vineyard in 1977, but
our
first commercial harvest was 83. And we spent the year celebrating that with our wine club, and we centered three of our wine club shipments this year around a theme. And they're kind of the core values that we've really set out as the pillars of our concept over the past few years. And one of them is tradition, because both we really have built our own internal tradition we care about, but also a lot of our values are really centered on being part of the conversation of the winemaking tradition historically. Mm-hmm. Which is why we are so focused on age-worthy wines. But then also the other two pillars are experimentation and exploration. And I think some people think that experimentation and exploration overlap a lot. And I get that. But really, one's about us, about what we can do. That's the experimentation. That's about us honing our craft, learning what we can do, getting better, always chasing the idea that we're not done learning or not done being better winemakers and better stewards. But then exploration is really about going and seeing what else is out there, both in exploring other concepts of tradition, different regional traditions that might inspire our winemaking, or literally going to a new place to make a new grape, to do a new thing. And so one's about, you know, tradition is essentially us interacting with history, one's interacting with nature, and one's interacting with people, with us, with what we do. And between those three kind of pillars, each of our wines and each of our, you know, series of wines kind of has a foot in at least two of those pillars.
Right.
And then, you know, and then some of them are all three. The handprint program is really our view of how we merge all of them. But, you know, the Hone series is about exploration, experimentation. The Snapshot series is about tradition and experimentation, or tradition and exploration, depending on how you want to look at it. And really everything we do kind of comes from these three core ideas that my dad, you know, I don't think he would have ever been able to summarize it that well. And we actually spent years distilling kind of all these ideas down to those three words. And I still don't feel 100% comfortable with how kind of limiting it feels. But, you know, the idea is that
But it does. It does hit. It hits it. I definitely think those are the right three words. So when people come to the tasting room, are they making an appointment? What's the experience, and how do those three pillars integrate into the experience I have as a customer?
We are open 7 days a week. We take walk-ins. We will also take appointments. We taste out of our winery in Healdsburg. You're sitting in the winery. You're between the tanks and a pallet rack. It's very chic.
It's urban chic.
Yeah, it's urban chic. You know, we've always felt like we should be spending money on the right things, and we don't think that, you know, a big Tuscan villa is quite the right thing.
It's a great feeling to go there.
Yeah, we really it's so annoying to say intentionally that we really try and be authentic, but really the whole idea is we expel our effort on the interaction, on the wine, and on trying to connect those two things, trying to connect people to our wines and get them to understand those values. So, you know, we put a couch in the middle of the winery, and you want to taste the wines, you want to see what we do, you're in it. and I try and spend time with every group if I have time, which I usually do. And I give people as much time as they want to get their questions answered overly verbosely.
So then is there a set tasting flight, or do you just go with what the customer, where they're at? Do you suss out, you know?
Beth will tell you we're pretty notorious for not sticking to whatever we told you we were going for.
There's no plan, yeah.
Yeah, and we, you know, we really want to show people that we can come to them. And so frequently we'll start pouring things and, you know,
and see where that leads.
Yeah, I love this, or oh, I love that. And, you know, and so maybe we'll.
So it's a very organic, branches off into where you're at, where what you're tasting and where that leads you.
Our wine club is super healthy. It's the core of our business. It's been the core of our business. We have wine club members that have been members since I was, you know, 7 years old.
Wow.
So to me, that really does speak volumes, because there's a lot of wineries, and I talk to a lot of people who, you know, they've been with this winery for so many years, but they drop out because, I mean, they're not dissatisfied. They just discovered somebody new. They're only going to drink so much wine. So if you have people that are really sticking with you for that many years, and I know that all of, like, Wine Road events, Catherine's always saying it's the wine club members really, you know, come, and they're supportive, and
yeah, we're actually always a little surprised. We're like, you're wine club members. You get special treatment any day.
Any day.
Yeah, you're, right. And so you're coming when we're busier and we don't have as much attention for you. And we would love to have you just come
on a
next
Tuesday.
Saturday.
Next Saturday.
Die hard support.
But
as a winemaker, I mean, you of course, you get to make the call. But every winemaker wants to be able to make all the wines that you make. I mean, they do. They just don't get that opportunity if they're working for someone else. You know, this is the program. These are the wines we need to produce. And maybe you can make this one other varietal this year.
Not going to lie. There's times where I've, you know, had small identity crises and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm, you know. Are we going to survive? Being a small winery is really hard. I guess I could go get a job making somebody else's wines.
Like,
and
then
I'm like,
I couldn't do it.
I don't think I could. I think I would get fired, because I'd be like, hey, I know that we're a Pinot Noir winery, but what about this? Like, how about we do an extended aging Sangio program from Heritage Clones?
Yeah,
and then the
idea.
Owner would be like, no. And I'd be like, but it's a great idea.
So many good ideas. Yeah. I think that's awesome. Well, and that's what keeps you interested and enthusiastic. And
that's actually the...
Has to feed you as well.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That I tell people all the time, if I had to make the six wines every year, I wouldn't be a winemaker.
No.
And that's how my dad was too. And so I think this is the only fit he could have had and the only fit I could have had.
Spot. I do think people love being able to be in the actual winery, and they like that feel of, you know, it is authentic. That is what it is. And it's right behind Longboard Vineyards, which is beautiful.
And we have a great relationship with Odette.
And, you know, Odette is awesome. But you see Longboard, and there's a giant new sign that says Longboard.
Yeah, he sure makes it look like that whole building's him, doesn't he?
Yes, it does. Yeah. But you have to drive around the back, and then there's a little sign that says Meeker. It's like, unless you're a diehard fan...
We have like five little signs that they add up to one big sign.
But they make me feel like when I see them, I feel like I'm in the, like I'm walking in an employees only, like I shouldn't, should I open that door?
I'm kind of fine with that. Actually, one thing we talked about was using one of our fire exits on the other side of the building as like a speakeasy entrance. Like the idea being that, like, you know.
The secret knock.
Yeah. No, we really want people to feel like they're in a working winery.
Yeah.
And
I feel like I shouldn't open the door. Yeah. I'm a rule follower, so I think, oh, am I going to be in trouble?
Yes. No, we get that a lot. And I realize that there's some polishing to do.
Yeah.
But no,
only thing.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm like the mom speaking.
Feedback is not only correct and noted and unfortunately has been kind of ignored for a few years. But yeah.
But the wines are awesome if people, you know, can find the door.
Yeah. We love getting to share what we do. It's the I tell people all the time, my dad would have given the wine away for free if he could have. And tried to for many years. and so yeah, you know, it's a big part of, you know, my dad loved nothing more than making wines and then sharing his joy with that process. And I'm a little different than him. I'm a more internal in the sense of like, I care more about process and my own view of the results than necessarily external feedback. And that's maybe I'm just more fragile than he was. But for me, the sharing is a big part of validating the cause, the reason, right? Mm-hmm. So, we're, you know, we've been members of the Wine Run for a long time. And I think that people look at us and they're like, oh my God, you do so many different things. You don't stay focused. And the doing the different things is the focus.
Yeah, right. That's the fun.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yes.
A lot of creative people do.
I'd say so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just wake up like a bundle of ideas and just have to like met out what's going to, you know, what to work on. It's hard. You know, it's not fun to be in here.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're talking about waking up with the ideas. I'm talking about trying to go to sleep with them.
Yeah, that's too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. So this is the best way for people, since there's no sign, is there a URL or website?
He's going to get back to the office today and go, we really need to make a sign.
Oh, no, that's the office has been telling me that.
I know.
No, meagerwine.com, and you can call us, the same phone number for the past 30-something years, 707-431-2148. Catherine will pick up probably, maybe Anne, or walk on in. We're behind Longboard in Healdsburg. We love surprises, you know, show up and, you know, bring your dog, bring your kid. We make popsicles out of grape juice for kids. We have fun with it. And we try and, give everyone a good time and meet them on whatever they're excited about.
Excellent. That's what's nice. I mean, I do think that you are really good about following the customer's lead. I mean, if I really was turned off by this, then you would move on to something else. And that's, you have the variety to do that, to find the right fit for every person.
We got a wide quiver. We can cover a lot of bases.
I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put all those details in the show notes. We'll put a link to these beautiful wines. Thank you so much, Lucas. I really enjoyed talking to you. This was wonderful.
We'll finish this bottle.
And thank you for bringing the punk pop.
Yeah.
Pop punk.
Yeah.
Pop punk. So I should mention again that I think it's April 11th. Once again, I don't have my notes, but we have our Spring Wine Road Wine Trail. I think there's 40 wineries. It's $50 a person for the day. All the details on wineroad.com.
Excellent. Okay. All right. We'll see you on the wine road.
Thanks.